Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. Today I'm joined by actor and filmmaker James Francis Flynn, whose audacious second feature effort, The Stick-Up Kid, centers on two generations of small-time Chicago muggers who attempt to escape their life of crime through R&B music. I never get tired of saying that premise because I think it sounds terrific.
Thanks, man.
It sounds great. So welcome to the show, James, and tell me just a little bit about your own background in filmmaking, because this is your second feature. You've also worked on other films in various capacities.
Yeah, I did my first movie as a writer-director. We shot it in the summer of 2007, back in my hometown in Oxford, Ohio. And it was called Eastern College, and it played at some film festivals in 2008, and then we sold it to DVD and video on demand, and it had a little run that way. And so after that, I had some folks who I knew and friends of friends who came to me because I had made a movie from start to finish and sold it. So they said, hey, help me out with my movie.
Sure.
So I've been doing that the last couple of years. I've been doing a little bit of acting and producing mostly. But I've been throughout this entire time, I've been eager to get back to directing something. And so The Stick-Up Kid is something that I wrote right when I moved to Chicago. And have done draft after draft and have been trying to get it off the ground.
Now, this was a finalist or a semi-finalist at the Sundance Film Festival Labs,
yeah.
which is really an interesting, you know, place to be as far as a screenwriter and then working within that group or at least working to sort of like be involved in that.
Right.
And so how has that evolved since that draft, you know, over the years? Has it evolved drastically?
It's evolved hugely. So I first moved to Chicago in 2004. Right after college, and I immediately started writing screenplays. And so the first one I did an adaptation of a George Saunders short story and then tried to get the rights for it. I mean, I didn't know anything about the business side of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I just wrote it because I had the passion to write it. And then I contacted him and tried to get the rights, and he was not interested in selling the rights, nor was his agent. So then I wrote this, and this is something that I had in mind for a long time. I sent it to the Sundance Labs. It got through the first round.
That's right. Yeah.
So I sent them more, and then nothing happened with it. So I kind of shelved it to do the Eastern College movie. But then I just kept coming back to it. It was something that I just couldn't get away from. Mm-hmm. And still can't. So I believe I'm on, I think the current draft is maybe the ninth or tenth draft. The original draft that I did write in 2005 was, like 180 pages maybe. I had read something, I'm a huge Paul Thomas Anderson fan, and I had read an interview with him. Where he originally pitched to New Line Cinema, Boogie Nights would be a 4-hour movie with a disco intermission.
I'd love to have seen that cut. I would have too.
So I think I was sort of in my 23-year-old go take on the world, change the world thing. I think I was trying to emulate that, like a big 3-4-hour movie with an R&B intermission, this would be. So now it's pared down quite a bit, and the storyline's changed significantly, and I think for the better.
Sure. Now, there was also, I think, a book in the mix as far as, like, something about Chicago muggers that you might have drawn from, like, maybe in the research angle
Like that. I've done so the original thing came about because my father taught sociology, and so one day when I was younger, I believe in high school, I picked up one of the books from his massive stacks of books, just randomly looking for something to read because I was a pretty voracious reader. And it was this book called Jones, Portrait of a Mugger. So it's about a small-time criminal, a mugger in the 70s in New York. And again, I don't know why it spoke to me, but it did, and I read it and read it again. And that was the original impetus. So when I first started writing what became The Stick-Up Kid, I was thinking it was going to be more of like an adaptation of that book. And then in the course of actually writing it, it really transformed. And It became a story about more about, you know, it incorporated my own experiences. And the more and more drafts I've done, the more it's gotten away from that. So the original inspiration is now but sort of a little tiny piece of
sure.
the whole thing.
Sure. And you did a really nice Kickstarter video on this where you say that you want to sort of like extend your father's legacy in sociology or that's somehow reflected in this. And tell me a little bit about that, because I think sociology and any sort of artwork, I think, are sort of intrinsically linked on some level. But like how specifically with this source material is it?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, you know, my dad, like I say, taught sociology, but the criminology wasn't his focus. That was something he did. I think earlier in his career and then sort of got away from. He was doing more sociology of religion and that sort of thing. But I don't know. I don't know if he had like prison pen pals or if he met people through his research in that field. But we would have, he was very into the church and into Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so part of it was he was trying to sort of be Christ-like and like befriending what's the right way to put it? Like, criminals in this respect, but he tried to like reach out to people who needed it. And so the point is we had a bunch of, we'd have people fresh out of prison, like come to our house and like have dinner and we like welcome them and that sort of thing. So, part of that was that formative experience of having, some like rough around the edges people around your house, and just trying to humanize them and understand their stories and how they got to be that way. So I think I'm trying to do that through storytelling. Mm. You know, I'm trying to do that same thing.
Sure. Oh no, I think that's a great answer. And just okay. Now I have to discuss some of the other just really audacious aspect. I like the word audacious.
Okay.
And I think, you know, with Paul Thomas Anderson, I mean, providing a sort of like inspiration model. I mean, he is someone who really shoots for the stars in every film that he does.
Yeah.
Is that what specific? Okay, before we go into that, just a little bit about why he's an inspiration.
Well, you know, you hear about these stories about filmmakers who, you know, they started making Super 8 films when they were like 6 years old or whatever. I was never that way. I came to it a little bit later. It was, I think the main thing was I had in this I graduated from high school in 1999, and I had a summer job, like a part-time summer job at a computer lab, and then I was living with my brother, and we were living really, you know, poor basically. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have air conditioning, so I would go to see movies that summer just to get, you know, in the air conditioning.
And let me just say, what a great year to see movies.
That's
there
exactly
so many
it.
Great films
yeah,
in 1999.
That's exactly it. I mean, 1999 had an amazing, you know, I think one of the best years of cinema. You know, you've got Being John Malkovich, mm-hmm. Three Kings, I'm blanking.
I mean, The Straight Story, I think,
the
is
The Straight
great
Story is incredible.
David Lynch films. Yeah.
The Iron Giant.
Yeah.
And of course, Magnolia came out later that year. But I don't remember the first time I saw her or how it was a thing, but Boogie Nights was just a big thing for me when I was around that age. I was, you know, it came out 2 years prior, but that was a big thing. And I guess it was just a movie that I really started to think, this is, you know, like I can see somebody putting their fingerprints on this, you know, and it was the first time I really saw that. And of course, he does some really flashy stuff. He's got really, you know, he's really subtle in a lot of ways too. But for a young person, like you see the flashy tracking shots and the disco and all that. So he was kind of my first in, and just that summer of movies. And then I went off to college at first at another school, the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. So after that summer, I was watching all the movies. And then at Evergreen, I took a film class there, or part of my block of classes had a film component. So then we really started to analyze film then, too. And it just became a thing that kind of built and built, and I became interested in that more and more. And so I think I got off track a little bit. What was your original question?
But just how you kind of glean inspiration from people like that who really is aiming for the stars in every film, and he's really working in a different sort of cinematic language while still refining his own, like, overarching, you know, vision and his voice and everything.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, I love that because what's really interesting to me is the ways that he melds what I consider, like, classical Hollywood cinema. But then he also tries to do something new, like the little color interludes in Punch Drunk Love, or, you know, the 15 minutes of no dialogue at the beginning of There Will Be Blood. You know, it seems like he's always trying to push. You know, he's pushing the language while telling stories that are, you know, like Boogie Nights is just, you know, a star was born, you know.
Exactly.
So he's telling
kind
of simple.
Goodfellas, melded with
Scorsese. The rise and fall mm-hmm. thing. So I like that about him. He's melding really kind of deceptively simple stories with pushing the cinematic language.
For sure. Now, and in this film, in The Stick Up Kid, music plays obviously a very important role in these characters' lives. Yeah. And what you've decided to do with this film is so fascinating. And I'll just mention another thing from that Kickstarter video that I loved was Amy Simetz.
Yeah.
Who I've always considered one of the best and most versatile, you know, actresses in the independent, you know, cinema at the moment. She mentioned something that one thing she would love to do at some point is, you know, be at, like, one of the screenings of a film and be in character, like actually be a character and sort of have, like, an audience participation angle. And so how did that story that she told you lead to this?
Yeah.
And tell me about what you want to do.
Sure. I don't remember the first time I met Amy, but the first time I saw her was in Joe Swanberg's movie Alexander the Last. Mm-hmm. And I saw a screening of that, and I was talking to Joe afterwards, and I said, "Amy, this girl, Amy, she's great. I mean, she has a somewhat minor role. I mean, the main character is played by Jess Wexler, but she plays her sister. But I just thought Amy was fantastic." And Joe said, "Well, she just wants to work, and she's working." And so... So I got in touch with her, and we talked about bringing her onto this movie, and I hope that she can still do that, even though I know that she's a little bit busier now than she was a couple years ago. But so we were talking about all kinds of stuff, and at that point she had directed a movie that I believe she's now buried. It was called City on the Hill. She wrote and directed it and, you know, shot the whole thing. And then
Recently did have a film that showed at festivals.
Yeah, she had a different
movie.
Some
kind of directorial effort.
Yeah, she had. This is her debut. It premiered at South by this year. It's called Sun Don't Shine.
That's right. Yeah.
So she had City on the Hill before that, and I don't know whatever happened with that. She can be kind of mysterious sometimes.
Sure.
But we were talking about City on the Hill, and it was right around when she had done the IFP labs. And she said she was talking to Scott McCauley, and, you know, it was a small movie. And so she won. I think it was about, like, revolutionaries or something. I'm a little unclear about it. But she said that her plan to distribute it was to take it on tour with herself and other actors in the movie in character, like, interacting with the audience. It sounded almost sketch comedy-esque in a way. Like, I don't think that would be the tone, would be comedy necessarily. So she wanted to sort of have an interactive component. And I have an image in my mind of me in my apartment when that happened, going like, you know, because I was working on this movie at the time and it had such a musical component. So I thought, I want to do the same thing, but just with music, and meld basically a concert with the film. Mm. And so that's the idea. So, I'm still trying to do that where, you know, we'd take the movie on tour. I built in musical interludes into the action. And so it would be something where, you know, you'd see part of the movie and then the band would play. And they would play, you know, during the credits in lieu of ending credits, you know, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And play over, hopefully the way I'm designed it too is that they would play during the climax of the movie. It would be sort of silent film-esque for the last, you know, 5 minutes or so, and they would be playing.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because I've seen some examples of this where they have a live orchestra playing during a film, and sometimes they have, I mean, sometimes it's very complex, like I know Spielberg did that for the re-release of E.T., where it's like they have certain sound cues, and they get,
like
I mean,
the
for that
John
they did
Williams
the whole
thing.
Score. Like, are you looking for specific moments for music, where it's just music, or are you
I basically wanted to do it like interludes, so it would be kind of at act breaks.
Oh, okay.
So the very beginning, like the opening titles. And then, you know, the first act break, what would be the intermission?
Sure. So it wouldn't necessarily be during the actual, like, dialogue.
No, it wouldn't be during the dialogue. Okay. And then, like I said, I plan to build in at the very end that they'll come back and be playing, like, sort of for the finale.
Sure.
And then, you know, I want them to also be playing, want the band to be playing at the beginning, like, as people are being seated, sort of in lieu of commercials and, you know, trailers and things like that.
Sure.
And just kind of make it an event and a night, you know, a night out for people.
So what sort of music are you inspired by while you're putting this material together? And what sort of music do you want included as well? And you want, like, sort of like a Motown vibe?
Yeah,
like
a Motown vibe. So the original draft, you know, the 180 page draft, it was originally supposed to be jazz music, because I had studied jazz music a little bit in college. But then it changed to this kind of R&B soul music when I went to see at the Double Door Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
Mm, all right.
So I saw them and I was like, oh no, this fits the vibe of this whole thing a lot better. So I switched it to that, and so it's that kind of stuff. Like I don't know if there's a term for it. It's like neo soul or something. I mean, there's a bunch of groups who are kind of taking the old, you know, 60s soul sound and updating it a little bit. So Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings would be one. Local group J.C. Brooks and the Uptown Sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Fitz and the Tantrums. Rafael Sadiq. Who else? And then there's some older guys who are really doing it, like Lee Fields and Charles Bradley. A lot of people on the Daptones records.
Yeah, I see. Mayor Hawthorne is another.
Mayor Hawthorne. Excuse me. Yeah, he's good too. So yeah, there's a bunch of people doing it, and I love that music. I love the old stuff too, and I love what people are, you know, doing to update it. And I think the vibe of all that music kind of fits in with what the storyline is too. So, I've reached out to a couple of those groups. I'm hoping to you know, get some at least one group or maybe more on board to provide the soundtrack.
That's awesome. And when you're working within a genre like the crime genre, where there's so many, it's been played so much in Chicago, and there's been all sorts of different perspectives. What are you doing to sort of, you know, like, obviously this is your own vision, but it's like, what do you want to do to sort of like make that genre fresh, I suppose, in that sense? Or what sort of, you know, approach are you planning for this?
Yeah, I hope it's something that's more like, for lack of a better way to put it, like more like street level. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of, you know, if you travel, especially around the world, and you tell people, oh, I'm from Chicago, a lot of times they'll be like, oh, Al Capone, you know, that kind of thing.
Which is now like romanticized for, like, you know, when you go to Portillo's or something. It's
right,
like now,
right.
It's like
they've
yesterday's
got like a Tommy
tragedy
gun.
Is today's,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they got a Tommy gun on the wall or whatever. Yeah, so I think people still weirdly have this view of Chicago as like a gangster city or whatever. So I want to get away from that a little bit and have it be more like a day-to-day street crime kind of thing. And especially with mugging, I mean, it's something that there's not – I mean, because it I don't know exactly how it works, but I think the police or the law, like, they put mugging just into like a general robbery category. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to get statistics on it, and there's not a lot of – information about it. I mean, there's that Jones book, but that's one of the few things, like, occasionally you'll find newspaper reports or whatever. But just that crime is fascinating to me because it is, you can't find much about it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've done as much research as I can. I've been doing some research, you know, personal research and things. So I want to talk about that crime more specifically, and especially these days it's been blowing up more because there's all kinds of mugging going on. I just heard the term yesterday, apple picking, where people will like specifically be robbing people of their iPhones of their iPads.
And that's just a constant thing people have, all, especially like on public transit in a big city like that. There's
all
those
the
things. And I love how the new L design has less chairs and it forces you to hold, you grasp onto one of those handles so that it just leaves your pockets completely vulnerable.
Your pockets and just, you know, if you're holding on with one hand to a rail or whatever, and if you got your iPad in the other and you're right by the door, somebody can just grab it and go. And that's it. So, and I think that happens quite a bit. And just the other day I saw another person at the place where I volunteer who had just gotten mugged. It's a weirdly pervasive crime, and so I want to explore that a little bit.
Sure, absolutely.
So hopefully that's the fresh take.
Yeah, oh, for sure, absolutely. Yeah, and with your acting background, because you had, like, you know, roles here and there for, you know, for some people's films, and actually two of my past guests on this very podcast, Nathan Adloff and Frank V. Rossi, worked on some of their projects as well.
Yeah,
and
I did.
And just those little experiences, do you think that's enhanced sort of your approach to directing actors in these? The situation.
I hope so. They, you know, people who I've directed would be the judge of that. I don't really consider myself an actor, but I like acting, and I think if you're trying to direct people, it's important to have knowledge of acting and hopefully hands-on skill with acting, because it's really frightening to act. I mean, I know for me, I get in a really nervous place. And I get very insecure, you know. They'll yell, you know, the director will yell cut, and I'll immediately go, "Was that okay? I don't know. You know, I hope I did a good job. You know, I hope it's what they wanted." So it's good to have that experience, so you can remember when you're directing other people that they're in a vulnerable place, and you need to really help them with that. I try. You know, if I don't look for acting roles, but if people want me to act, I, you know, pretty much, unless some red flag goes off that they're a weirdo or something,
sure.
I always say yes, because I want to always be, you know, aware of how hard it is and how vulnerable it is.
Oh, sure. And I'm sure it's so helpful to have that on camera, off camera, behind the camera, in front of the camera experiences, to have that best of both worlds.
Well, yeah. And, you know, actually another good aspect of acting is you get to hang out with other filmmakers, and you get to see how they run their set or how they direct and stuff too. So it can be pretty educational.
Sure. Now let me ask a little bit about this actor that you worked with on both of the films.
Eastern College.
Eastern College. Mm-hmm. You worked with John Dominic on
that.
And he's also signed on for playing the lead tentatively, or he's definitely the lead in this one?
Yeah, he's it's pretty much definite. He is a guy I went to college with. He was he definitely did theater, and I think he also did mass communications at Miami University. And I remember seeing him in some plays at school. I mean, I was going to a bunch of plays that time because I was in the theater world a little bit then, and I was also looking at a lot of the actors who were available for short films that I was doing at that time, in particular my senior thesis film. So I saw him, and I actually was very, very close to just shoehorning it, like writing a new part for him in my senior thesis film, just to work with him. And I didn't end up doing that, but I had seen him in plays, and just he had this really great stage presence, and I just liked him. So I didn't end up using him for that senior thesis film. But when I did Eastern College, I wrote all the roles for people that I knew. It was kind of that Robert Rodriguez thing of make a movie with what you have, like list all the things you have, you know, and make a movie with what you have. So. I knew that I had access to a college town and like a house and my friends and who had experience acting, but I didn't know who was going to play that main role in the ensemble. And then I forget how I thought of John, but I called him up out of the blue. We had really only met a couple times, you know, a couple years prior, but I was like, "Hey, I thought of you for this role." And I think he was a bit surprised. Because he was just living in Cincinnati and he was in nursing school, I think. And so he was really excited about it, and so he ended up playing the role, and we spent, you know, all that month together in the summer of 2007, you know, shooting the whole thing. It was a really good experience, and luckily, not only do I think he's a good actor, but he's just become a really, really good friend. I mean, he just got married last month, and I was in the wedding. That sort of thing. So we're good buddies, and you know, when I was going back doing this role, I sort of wrote it, you know, partially for him, I would say. You know, I wrote it with him in mind, that's for sure. And there's a lot of personal stuff that he and I have talked about that I've incorporated in, and that will, I think, play to his strengths and really make it a really good role for him. I want it to be a showcase role for him. So hopefully that will happen.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool. And Eastern College, that wasn't that film about like young adults kind of going back to their high school town or something like that? Or
No, it was, the storyline, it was four college roommates. Yeah. When the movie starts, they've just graduated and they're looking for a summer house. And so they end up moving into this summer house. And so it's just the course of their summer right after they've graduated, like before, you know, it's almost that purgatory thing.
Sure.
Like, we're not really adults yet, you know, we're not really like getting on with our life yet. We've got this summer to just, party and pick up girls and kind of figure out who we really are and enjoy, you know, each other's company before we leave. So it's just about that. It's an ensemble kind of comedy and with some drama mixed in.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, because what I mean, at least in this case, I mean, it's so much about a man looking back at his past too. It's like it's sort of like juxtaposing the past and present. And I mean, not necessarily with Eastern College. I mean, that's more about just people in transition. But is there something that attracts you about, you know, shifting between two different time periods, or kind of like how the past is, you know, linked to the present, and sort of how they affect each other?
That's a really good question. I don't know. Other than just I'm a pretty nostalgic guy, you know, and so I tend to look back at things very wistfully in my own life. So maybe it's just using film to explore that a little bit.
Sure.
That's the only thing that comes to mind. This is the part of filmmaking that gets really like almost psychoanalytical, you know.
Sure.
Why do you do the things that you do, you know? It's hard to know exactly.
But oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But that's a really smart question. I don't know.
Yeah, I think at least just from an audience member's perspective, I think there is just this, you know, an inherent appeal in looking back at certain things and sort of like, you know, analyzing the past and seeing how, you know, looking through that nostalgic veil, but also seeing that it wasn't all, you know, pitch perfect back then. Looking past the caricatures, I suppose.
Right. Know? Yeah. I hope that was really the idea with Eastern College specifically was to try to make a college movie that was hopefully a bit more realistic and wasn't all just fun, you know. I mean, there's some really hard stuff that those characters go through, it's just, I don't know, maybe like a bittersweet look at, you know, at that time in life, I guess.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and the Stick Up Kid sounds fascinating. So before we leave, can you tell me just what are some of your goals as far as like what has to happen now for this project, or what are you sort of working on as far as like, you know, which stage, you know, before you actually go into production, you know, are you sort of, you're still kind of raising funds at the moment?
Yeah, I'm still raising funds, and that's been going on for a while. We're in the middle of a Kickstarter campaign at the moment, so we're looking to raise $25,000 via Kickstarter, and we've got some fun rewards available for that, and so that'll be hopefully that'll be one part of our fundraising model, which is the Kickstarter, and then the private equity, and then we're looking for in-kind donations. We're utilizing the federal and state tax credits, as well as we're looking for sort of like product placement and sponsorship stuff. So we're trying to sort of do a really, you know, piece together model of financing. Right now the main thing is I've done some investor presentations. I'm doing another one on Monday in Wicker Park, and then the Kickstarter. So those are the main two things we're working on at the moment.
Very cool. Yeah. And so people can look up your film on Kickstarter just as the Stick Up Kid, feature film with a live tour.
Yeah, that's right. The Stick Up Kid feature film with a live tour. So if you want to go check that out, that's on Kickstarter right at the moment. I think we've got 2.5 weeks left on that.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for taking time to speak with me today. And I wish you all the best in your project. I'll definitely be keeping my eyes peeled on all the updates on that. And for all my recent reviews and interviews, you can check out HollywoodChicago.com and Indie-Outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.